Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 278, we bring on our close friend and guest of the program, Dr. M. Ali Khan, to discuss his recent publication on fellow perceptions of private equity acquisitions. These acquisitions have increased in ophthalmology over the last couple of years, and Dr. Khan's study aims to see what do trainees think about it, and what sort of information can we provide trainees in the future to make good job decisions, and as well for them to feel supported by their mentors. As always, you can find this podcast episode and all our other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. Remember that there are a list of financial disclosures in the episode description, and you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with one of our frequent guests and friend of the program, Dr. M. Ali Khan from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, thanks for taking the time tonight.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
So we're here to talk about this paper that was your brainchild. And really, I think this is important to talk about because we got to give a voice to all the fellows out there, fellows who listen and fellows in training and the trainees who have concerns about a hot topic, which is private equity transactions in ophthalmology and specifically in vitreoretinal surgery. So this is a paper that was published in Ophthalmology Retina. The title is Private Equity Transactions, Perceptions of U.S. Vitreoretinal Surgery Fellows. It's been out in the last month. And Ali, tell us a little bit about the background for why you chose to conduct this study, how you did it, and what did the results show?
Yeah, so there's been obviously a lot of discussion about private equity, but it always seemed to be informal, almost rumor-like or backroom kind of discussions without any real data or insight from people involved in the process. And I think that placed a lot of younger people who are either in training or looking at jobs in a little bit of a confused place. So there's actually an article in Ophthalmology, Evan Chen, who is actually an applicant for retina fellowship currently this year from Yale Medical School, was the first author. And they described all of the ophthalmology and optometry transactions in private equity up until 2019, from 2012 to 2019. They showed, as everyone has known, an acceleration of transactions. So lost in there, I think, is a discussion about what does that mean for young ophthalmologists. I think we've heard a lot about how this may be good or bad for older ophthalmologists who are full partners, and maybe how this is good or bad for junior associates per se, but what about trainees who are interviewing in this environment and going into it firsthand? I think that was a part of the discussion that was lost. So part of the purpose of this paper was to actually survey those people. So it was an online survey of third year residents who matched into retina fellowships in the US, and also first year fellows who are currently training in US fellowships, to survey their perceptions of these private equity transactions. What are they worried about, and what do they wish they knew more of in kind of a career advising and information gathering type of aim? So the results of the study are summarized in the paper pretty well, but I think the gist of it are a few things. So the major concerns that the trainees had were two main topics. One was job security, so the security of their position over the mid and long term, and then oversight over clinical operations. So about a third of respondents said job security was their most common concern, and another third, the most common concern, was oversight over clinical operations. Secondly, they emphasized the need for education about PE during training. So under half of the survey respondents expressed confidence in their understanding of PE and how that model differed from other employment models, with 70% of them supporting education about PE being a required component of AUPO fellowship accreditation. So I thought that was a pretty strong insight from their responses. And a few other things. One thing that's come up is conflict of interest. So this is one of those particularly sensitive subjects. And one of the questions was, do you think that ophthalmologists who are in national leadership organizations who have sold their practice to PE does that in any way represent a conflict of interest? And, you know, that controversy has been discussed in the dermatology literature. They had actually a New York Times expose about how an article was accepted and then recalled because of some of these conflict of interest concerns. So in this survey, about 40% of the respondents said, yes, I think there is some conflict of interest, but an equal or slightly greater amount, 46%, were unsure, meaning they simply didn't know if a conflict of interest was really there. And I think that underscores a lack of understanding about PE in general and sort of the uncertainty behind it. And 13% said there was no conflict of interest at all. So a pretty even mix in that response. And then lastly, a desire for national organizations to play a role. So 88.2% of their respondents were hoping a national organization would be more formally investigating the effects of PE on ophthalmology in general, but also the effects on younger ophthalmologists entering the workplace. Of the organizations that could be investigating it, the American Academy of Ophthalmology was the one chosen to be the most appropriate. So the need for or desire for education during training, the want to sort of resolve any potential conflicts of interest, if any, and then the lastly, the role of national organizations in investigating this more formally were my main takeaways.
Great, great summary, and really a great study, and it's really great for the, I really, most appreciation goes to the fellows who filled it out and actually contributed their opinion and let their voice be heard. You know, let's go a kind of a different points to talk about, right? So let's first talk about, I think the most important thing, you can talk about concerns, but I think it's the lack of understanding component, right? Because I think this is the part where anytime you have a lack of understanding about anything, that's going to drive concern. Because if you don't understand the system or contract you're signing, then it makes you feel a little uncomfortable as a educated human being. So, you know, this idea that 48% said, I'm confident. The tipping point of that is 52% either are like, I'm somewhat confident, or like, I'm not really, I have no idea what these models differ in terms of my employment models. And maybe that's biased because maybe some of these people haven't looked at the contract specifically and haven't gone through that process yet. And then the idea is, when you kind of reference the discussion, none of the national organizations at the time you wrote this paper really have any sort of educational resource for fellows to educate themselves. So, you know, I think there's been a little bit of a fixation. I think you'd agree that kind of should we sell, should we not sell, should we sell, should we not sell? It's a financial question, it's a moral question, it's ethical question. But I think the real reality question for a fellow, they're not the one making those decisions. So the real question is, what should we be doing to help those people make those decisions? I mean, obviously you ask questions about organizations to drive that thought process, but why isn't there that education, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I think there's two things. One is there's somewhat of kind of a taboo or mystery, I think, about discussing PE, particularly from those who have sold, and kind of this perception of not necessarily knowing who to trust with information. So a few of the questions in the survey were about, you know, if you were looking at a job that was PE owned, which type of physician in the practice would you trust? And it was, you know, inverse to age and number of years in the practice. So, you know, the fellows were much more comfortable asking junior associates and felt their responses were trustworthy versus kind of the senior partners who were full partners when they sold. And if these are the people who are typically the ones that our fellowships are saying, hey, you should talk to this person or that person about this job, it becomes uncomfortable if you're not comfortable asking that person questions about PE when those are the people who sold. And if your mentors are in an academic department or in a private practice who did not sell, they also might not know all the details or also might not feel comfortable having you ask, quote unquote, their friends or colleagues that did sell, to not sort of come off with any sort of negative connotation. So I think there's sort of a fear that if fellows ask these questions, they're going to be viewed negatively by the potential job offer. And two, people who haven't gone through the process simply don't know. And, you know, there's non-disclosure agreements and a lot of these sales, so junior associates may not be able to fully tell you what they really think. And, you know, I think that is the part where I think if there was a bit of a more coordinated effort, say by the AUPO or some larger education-oriented program to really bridge that gap, I think the fellows would feel more comfortable. But currently, I still don't think that's there. And I think both of us trained fellows, who applied last year in this kind of environment, who would always ask us, like, what do you think about PE? What do you think I should ask? And, you know, even I couldn't give them the greatest answers to these questions. So I do think we just as a retina community need to talk about it a little bit more, and not necessarily in a good way or a bad way, or sort of put judgment or any sort of negative connotation, but simply, you know, we got to let people know what to expect. We need to let our trainees know what they're getting into and how to talk about it without feeling uncomfortable. And I hope part of this paper will do that.
Yeah. And look, we don't have to get into specifics, but there's two of us here on this podcast. And initially we talked about the goal was kind of get a lot of people on this podcast talking about this subject. And I can't say I talked to every person, but I talked to a few people. And, you know, I think people in general are a little gun shy about putting themselves in a position, whether they have a potential conflict or not. They don't want to upset a friend. They don't want to upset a colleague. They don't want to upset a mentor. Who knows? It's not worth getting into the discussion in case it bothers somebody. And it's interesting because it's, like you said, it's a self-perpetuating cycle. The more uncomfortable we are to talk about it, the more uncomfortable people are like, I actually don't want to be the one person who talks about it because no one else wants to. And this idea of conflict of interest, right? We are better as a field than we were 10 or 15 years ago about saying, you know, I'm going to go talk about AMD, but I've got a conflict of interest because I accept money from Genentech or Regeneron, or I want to talk about vitreoretinal surgery, but I'm going to talk about the Alcon platform because I have a consultant, you know, fee from Alcon. And that's kind of expected at this point, if you're a member of these organizations or on the podium. We haven't had that for PE yet. And the problem is what you referenced. We don't know what those conflict of interests are, right? So are those conflict of interest tangible financial conflicts, right? Are people unwilling to talk badly, or do they want to talk well about it? Because, for example, a lot of young people are saying, well, they're going to get another bite out of a second sale. They're going to get an extra multiplier. They're getting more equity for the shares they got in the sale. Or is it simply they have a partnership with an organization and they don't want to speak ill of that or badly? Just like if you brought me on to talk about the University of Miami, my employer, you don't want to speak anything that could be perceived as negative for your employer. Those are kind of two different sort of conflicts, but it all factors into the idea that, like, there's more of a generational gap throughout society than ever before. This whole idea of, okay, boomer, okay, millennial. We're kind of seeing that gap emerge in retina, not so much because of those factors, though they may play a role, but because of this. I think this has become a big kind of, I'm blanking on the word, but it's the wedge that's kind of, it's driving a wedge between the generations. And it's not necessarily good for the future health of collaboration in the field. And the non-disclosures, like, I'm sure these companies, which are way smarter than you and I about the business, they have real financial reasons for having a non-disclosure agreement for a junior associate or someone who gets brought into the practice. It actually is not helpful in terms of making this a better conversation or attracted people. But again, maybe they're in the calculus and they say, well, it's actually better for us to make this more nebulous. But that increases sort of the paranoia and fears. Like, well, why are they making it nebulous? When is the other shoe going to drop? And so that's part of the thing that people can't answer. And so, like I'm going to give you a quote, right? So David Williams, who is part of the Minnesota group, the large VRA group, they sold to private equity recently. And he's interesting because he's a guy who came out and spoke against private equity and wrote against private equity a couple of years ago. And he's come back and written for. And so I'm going to quote him. We're not going to print it. This was the quote. Back in 2019, he wrote, I had a dream the other night. As I recall, a few years ago, a retina practice rejected an opportunity to partner with other ophthalmology groups in private equity deals, including a so-called horizontal national aggregation of some of the best retina practices. We were happy with our current success, confident in our independent future, mistrustful of PE, skeptical of purported benefits, and afraid of the risks. Our non-partner physicians were opposed to PE, and we feared we wouldn't be able to attract new high-quality physicians after a deal. For a while, we continued to do well, but eventually multiple factors began to impact us. Downward pressures on fees were relentless. Change in government policy for Medicare Part B drugs eliminated profits that boosted our incomes. Increased local competition reduced our referral volumes. Rising fixed costs combined with decreasing revenue drove our overhead through the roof. Our incomes dropped 50% from the peak. And although we continued to do well compared to most people, the older physicians didn't think it was worthwhile to keep working. I'd heard other practices had been able to maintain higher incomes, but since marginal tax rates were approaching 70%, the physicians were pretty discouraged and many were retiring. This is what he wrote. I'm apologizing. This is what he wrote now in 2021 or 2020. And he has a follow-up where he talks about all the benefits of PE, which I'll get to. But in 2019, he wrote the exact opposite, where he wrote, you know, he had this dream, and I'll just summarize again, not to read the whole thing. After four, here's what he wrote as the final thing, right? After 6 years, I heard that our PE firm had a buyer for our entity. Apparently, the price was much lower than we all hoped. We all wanted to get it and it seemed like a dumb deal. Management fees over the last 6.5 years were higher than I imagined. My equity stake was worth less than I calculated in my head. Oh, well, I wasn't sure what the new contract terms would be. I have a new employer, but I was resigned to stay. Oh, well, I decided to stay and make the best of it. 9 to 5 a day, I needed the money. Again, people are allowed to change their opinion. He was very good about explaining. This is in Retina Times from ASRS. Again, national organization releasing publication to express his opinion. And obviously, he will know more about it now that he is involved in the sale. So you can't just say he changed his mind because of a conflict of interest. Maybe he understands it better than he did 2 years ago. But it would be really nice if you could have someone who sold actually list credible downsides, right? So like he tries to be objective. And again, I'm not, he's writing objectively. He's writing about what happens to the non-partner positions. And he's like, PE generates significant concerns for non-partner positions, micromanagement, loss of clinical autonomy, impact of future transactions, curtailment of future earning potential. And he goes through all of these and he's kind of like, you know, retina specialists will continue to make plenty of money. And there's a lot of upside, for example, for getting the capital gains income, the equity income. You know, the thing that I don't know, and again, we don't know enough about these deals. I just struggle to see how the traditional partner agreement, you join a retina practice, was never a guarantee, right? It was all sort of a handshake. You join the practice. If it's a good practice, if you do your job, you're going to be offered partnership in X amount of years and chance to buy in. But it was never guaranteed contractually, right? They could always tell you at the end of it, hey, you know, this isn't working. We're not going to bring you as a partner. But we know this. There are groups that are famous for this. And you know what? They don't attract people because they have a reputation for this. And then there were groups that did do it routinely because if you were good and you did your job, you got offered a deal. This sort of thing is a little different because I don't think people feel as comfortable with the handshake deal here. And maybe they should, but maybe just because the track record isn't there or because it's an amorphous sort of organization, they don't feel as comfortable kind of putting aside, you know, certain things for a future gain or waiting for some sort of contract to kick in the future. And because I think a lot of the senior partners, I'm assuming they understand it. Either they don't understand it or they're not willing to come out, like you said, in an organization and explain it to younger people. There is a fear that they don't quite understand it either. And that we're kind of all just players in this business equity. So long prelude to this question. We talked about they should be doing more education. We talked about maybe organizations should take a leadership. I referenced the conflict of interest issue. But what is going to be the tipping point where you as an attending in your practice are going to be comfortable recommending that your fellow take a private equity job? What sort of process do you recommend go through? You're going to have them always go through a contract lawyer, or who are they going to talk to, for example, to kind of get an objective opinion?
Yeah, same thing. You know, one of the struggles is that a lot of these deals are very different from each other. So one private equity scenario is going to be very different than the other. So while conceptually they might be similar, you know, they could be very difficult to compare. But, you know, I don't know exactly who I would ask. You know, I personally have not gone through the process of evaluating anything from, you know, sale as a, you know, partner, junior partner, associate. So I personally don't have experience with that. But similar to what the fellows who responded in the survey said, you know, I don't think we know who to ask. And unfortunately, if a lot of very influential or key opinion leader ophthalmologists have sold their practice, you know, these are people that we generally look to as leaders of the field, who we'd seek advice and talk to them and sort of get, you know, the type of answers we're looking for. But, you know, if we lose that ability to sort of, you know, ask these people or feel like we're going to get all of the answers that we're looking for, I think that's where this mistrust or lack of trust in knowing or being able to, you know, believe what you're hearing is coming from. And that's why I think having a little bit more of a formal source from an educational point of view, or making it a goal of all of our training programs to at least protect our fellows or at least empower them to make the right decisions is going to be important. Now, you know, the article I referenced earlier by Evan Chen, you know, the median holding period prior to the second sale of those organizations was 3.5 years. So you were technically signing on to a job that in 3.5 years on average may change completely. And you might not have any, you know, ability to change that or or, you know, have influence over that process since you're not going to be an owner. And, you know, one of the questions in the survey is, when would you consider, you know, joining a PE practice? And the most common response was simply, I need to because of geography, or I did not have another option. So again, you know, we're into situations where people are entering jobs simply because they don't have a choice. And, you know, that's a different type of discussion. But I think that's where a lot of trainees especially are feeling, you know, down about this whole process. You know, they don't have an option. They have to take this job where they're not necessarily, you know, confident that this is good for their future. And that's really not an overarching sentiment that was present when we were looking for jobs. And that was not that long ago. So I do think that that culture needs to change as more and more retina practices are selling. You know, since the publication of that article by Evan Chen, 7 additional retina practices have sold. So it's not a small problem. And these are some of the more influential practices in the country. So either we're missing something, or we simply need to learn more about it. And I don't think ignoring it and sort of watching it happen and finding out later, you know, we were maybe misguided is the right choice. And maybe that process needs to come from younger people. Maybe that needs to come from people like us who are young, but, you know, not yet even mid-career. But we need to have at least a discussion. And I don't think that discussion's happened well enough to this point.
You know, you referenced the idea of physicians coming in feeling maybe unhappy or trapped, and that contributes to burnout, that contributes to lower productivity than you expect. And it's not good to have unhappy employees in general. You can look at dollars and cents and things like that, but no matter whether you're talking about an employee who's a technician in your practice, a photographer, or a junior associate, you want them to be happier. You don't do everything to make them happy. You have to focus on the good of the practice or the organization, the hospital, the institute, but you generally want your employees to be happy because they're going to do a better job. And again, you have two different kind of roles. There's better patient care, which doesn't always equate with better financial output, which are two different sort of measures for a business organization, or if you're clear more about the holistic part of it, and hopefully healthcare organizations factor both of those in. But like, but my thing is, so who's going to be the advocate, right? So like, if you're a private equity firm, I would hope that if you actually sit and think, you're going to increase the value of your organization more if you have motivated employees. And if your employees are coming in kind of down, even if they're objectively in the same situation, you can have the exact same situation, but be unhappy about it or happy about it, depending on whether you feel trapped in that situation, right? So maybe if they had more information up front, they could take the job with a smile and say, you know what, I'm actually really happy to take this job. But that's not the feeling we're getting from this generation, right? That's not what we're referencing. And that's not what we're seeing in this paper. And then maybe if the partners are saying, you know what, we're sold to private equity, but I really care about the longevity of this group that I built and I grew, and it's been 20 or 30 years. I want whoever I bring in to be really successful and happy because I want this group to continue. This is part of my legacy. Well, then you got to have those people come in happy from the beginning too. You want them to stick for the long haul. You don't want people to move around. You want people to be committed and have a loyalty to the organization as well. And again, so you got to have people be happy. And happiness does not always equate to the amount of money you pay someone in their salary. Their happiness does not always equate to the bonuses or the benefits or even sometimes the call schedule. It correlates to, do you feel like you were put in a situation to make a decision on your own as a human being? Human beings don't like feeling like they were trapped. They like feeling like they made an independent decision. You referenced the idea of key opinion leaders. What we really need is a couple of these key opinion leaders to go up on the podium and say, speak to fellows and say, hey, I'm Dr. Jay Sridhar. I have a conflict of interest in a way because I am part of this organization that sold. And when we resell, this is the amount of money I stand to make from it multiplied. This is what my finances will look like. But that's not why I'm here to talk about the pros and cons. I'm here because I actually believe in this model. But I'm telling you this up front so you can feel a little more comfortable. Okay, this is what this guy's coming from. And again, money in medicine is almost taboo, but I feel like this is like if Ali Khan, if I go and interview at Will's Eye Residency and Ali Khan interviews me and Ali's like, you got to go to Will's. Well, it means more to me if Ali's like, you know, I was a Will's resident. I'm biased. I'm a Will's attending now. I'm biased, but I think this is a fantastic fit for you. I think, again, maybe it's my personality. I think many people appreciate when someone puts their biases up front, even if you give them the same information, because it makes you feel at least that they're being a little more genuine and honest about what's going on. And maybe that's too far to have people put their financial kind of situation and stuff up there. But we do that with disclosures all the time. We don't ask for the dollar amount, but I don't know. I'm just trying to think of how that would work, right? So how are you going to get fellows in the room or in a Zoom meeting and have someone talk to them and not have the fellows tune out halfway through saying, this person, I don't want to listen to them because I don't trust what I'm hearing.
From the results of this survey, I think you need to have enough young people, actually. I think the younger people who are junior within the group were deemed more trustworthy in their statements than people who were full partners, simply because, you know, I don't think anyone really thinks that people who are full partner who sold would be unhappy with the decision. And that might not necessarily be true. And, you know, there might be some people who didn't want to sell and maybe hear from them why. But, you know, if you're perceived to have had a big financial payout or benefit, you know, it's hard to say, you know, why you would be unhappy. But, you know, again, I think if you're not having that open communication, you just simply don't know that. So I do think having younger people who are in these groups who joined at various stages would be helpful. I think it would be helpful if there was a little bit more of a national organization presence, not only to guide career advising, but also to investigate, is this model actually affecting the practice of ophthalmology? And that might actually take a few years, and by then it's a little too late, but at least feeling like that was being actively researched would be a start. And I personally don't feel that, and I personally don't know of any research actively ongoing into it, other than what's been said in some commentary saying we're looking into it, but I haven't really heard much beyond that. So I think you need to get the right people in the room who may be perceived to have less conflict of interest, but in general, a greater conversation. Now, I've heard fellows say that at some of these meetings, early career sections, et cetera, you only hear from a few people who say, look, it is what it is. You know, the model's not going anywhere. And the fellows are sort of left just as kind of uncertain as they walked in. And that's, you know, anecdotal, but I personally don't think it's a good thing for trainees to feel that way. And we at least have a responsibility to give them the information to make their own decisions. So I think if we had real research, and I think if we got the right people in the room to discuss it, and I think from this article, the trainees are telling us who they think those people might be, that would be a good start.
Last question, Ali, then I'll let you go. So what lesson, you referenced the dermatology literature early on, right? So what lessons can we take specifically from other fields like dermatology? Even in derm, you said there was some controversy over pulled articles, things like that. Are there fields of medicine with significant private equity entry that are doing a better job, and how are they doing it in ways that we can learn from?
Yeah, I think the fields that have been traditionally referenced have been dermatology, orthopedics, and even urology, and some nursing homes. So the literature for those fields is very different, of course. And again, the literature is not robust. There's really not a ton of outcomes-based data. And, you know, there's reports of, you know, disaster stories that I think make people fearful of PE. And those might be outliers. But, you know, I think the preponderance is somewhat either very positive or very negative. And there's not a lot of, I think, objective sort of middle of the road type of analysis. And part of that is because we need data. And again, that we don't have access to unless a private equity group would release that. And I don't really know why they would or if they have, but certainly not in anything that I've read. And in the dermatology, the paper that got the most controversy was simply because the authors pointed out people who had potential conflicts of interest, national or organization leadership roles, who were trying to potentially, you know, prevent a journal from publishing the article as is, and actually ask for revisions, and that were actually revised and resubmitted. And, you know, nothing like that has happened in ophthalmology, but I think it just speaks to the fact that if you just have an open conversation, we don't have to have these perceived conflicts of interest sort of dominate the story, and instead actually have an honest conversation between people starting in this field and people who may be ending in this field shortly. But I think the lesson that I've learned is that transparency actually keeps the field together and not the other way around. So hopefully we can do that in ophthalmology and in retina, but you know, this is just starting. The number of acquisitions have accelerated, but they're only a few years old. So we might not know more information for a few years, but I don't think it's good to just sort of keep our head in the ground and just have rumors swirling, but you know, maybe that's just us.
Ali Khan, thanks so much for publishing the article, giving the fellows a voice. Special shout out to Ophthalmology Retina for publishing this and getting it out there. Because like you said, in the dermatology literature, they had problems getting some of the data published. So this is good to kind of just get this out. And for fellows who are out there listening, Obviously, we can always do a follow-up to talk about questions, bring on people to talk about this. Maybe we need to bring on, you know, in unaffiliated lawyers, things like that, for these panels to talk about the sort of things that are important for these contracts, things like that. I don't know. We just got to be creative, like you said, in terms of educating and making this an open conversation. Ali?
Yeah.
I feel like we have to talk. I know we have to go. James Harden got traded yesterday. 2-minute thoughts from Ali Khan. James Harden to the Nets for 8 picks, like 6, well, I guess it was 4 picks, 3 swaps, and another pick from the Cavs. The Cavs, I don't know what they're doing. They gave away a pick somehow for Jared Allen. Oladipo to the Rockets, LeVert to the Pacers. 2-minute thoughts from Ali Khan.
I'll first say, if you are an applicant to residency, you should go to Will's.
Brooklyn Nets. We're releasing this after match today, Brooklyn. So no chance, yeah. My friend, that will work. Okay, keep going.
The Brooklyn Nets seems to have a model of giving up a lot of picks. James Harden is an outstanding player, but I still think the Lakers beat that team, particularly if Kyrie Irving is not playing.
Wait, but Ali, we just talked about conflicts of interest. What's your conflict of interest to state before we...
I'm a Lakers fan, and I believe the Lakers will win another championship.
Okay, there we go. I'm curious to see how it works. I am going to predict that it does not work in the way that they want it to, which is winning a championship. I would not be surprised to see them make the finals. There have been more dysfunctional star-studded teams that have come out of the East. I think the Heat in year one were more cohesive than this team, but didn't fit together very well. I think the Cavs at times didn't look like they made any sense, and they still made the finals from the East. But the East is not easy. You know, you've got Milwaukee, you've got Philly, you've got Boston. Miami's been not great, but they're lurking. The Pacers are frisky. I don't know. And I said this to guys in a text. I still am not comfortable as of today, January 13th or 14th, 2021, picking the Nets versus the field to come out of the East today. Maybe in a month when this comes out and they've won like all their games in a row, maybe that looks stupid. I'm just trying to visualize how that offense works. And defensively, I'm also trying to visualize what are they going to, like, they don't have another center in the roster. Their only center in the roster is DeAndre Jordan, who hasn't been starting. So, and like the Lakers always get like this mid-year pickup that helps them a lot. I wonder if the Nets will land one of those guys later, but they don't have any assets left to trade. They literally cannot trade another pick or pick swap until my 45th birthday, something like it's some birthday in the future. It's many birthdays away.
Yeah, they. I think they have just a mid-level exception or a trade exception or something. But I think the big question mark is Kyrie. I think Harden and KD would figure it out, but Kyrie is an outstanding player, but definitely a wild card. So the East is definitely more interesting. I will give.
West is boring. Lakers are going to win the West.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm excited to see what happens. In the playoffs if we actually get there with this COVID business.
Last question, if the Lakers make the finals, I know you're probably not going to be nervous because they're going to be favored against anyone, but which team would you least like to play in the finals as of today? Like, which team would you be like, I'm not really worried, but this is the, I would have rather played everyone else in the East?
I'd probably say I'd be most concerned about Brooklyn simply because of KD, and the ceiling on that team is high.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure if that ceiling will be achieved. But I think we got the Bucks. I think we got the Heat. I think we got the Sixers. So it'd probably be Brooklyn just because of the ceiling.
You didn't say Boston. You left Boston out.
Mm,
not worried.
Not worried about Boston. Yep.
Okay. All the Boston fans out there love that. Matt Weed is listening somewhere. Okay. Ali, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for writing this article, and have a great night.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Thanks again to Dr. Khan for discussing this subject and for publishing that paper. Remember, you can find this episode and all previous episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 278 episodes, including this one, found on the website, sorted by category and archived. A great resource to go back to and listen to. I had a recent med student tell me he was doing a chart review, needed to have something in the background to take his mind off. And so he burned through, 20 or 25 of these podcasts in the course of a couple of days. So you can have them on the background. They're really convenient on the go. And again, they're all available there, as well as in the Apple Store and Android Store on your mobile device. You can also find us directly on our website. And if you go to the website and click on the Contact Us link, You can reach us directly. You can also email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. There is an email link that you can enter your email and get updates on the most recent episodes. Find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And again, feedback is the lifeblood of what we do. We love getting feedback, and as we head into 2021 and beyond, we'd love to hear from you. Many thanks to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Vinicasa for preparing this episode and the accompanying social media. Listeners, thank you for what you do, the articles you're being published, the conversations you inspire here, and of course, the patient care you deliver on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.